Midlands Today with O'Brien's Hyundai Mullingar. The all-new Ioniq 5. Discover the electric life. Hyundai. On to better. Midlands Today with Ronan Berry on Midlands 103.
A very good Monday morning to you all. Hope you're all doing well, had a good weekend. One thing it's hard to escape is the temperature. It has been so warm and so mild out there. It's a little bit unusual. We probably have an idea what might be causing that, but let me know. It's been very, very different. What's been happening for you? I noticed actually slugs climbing all over my front door in Port last night, and even flies, dare I even say midgets, flying around the yard, coming into the porch as well, all over, all around the yard lights. Bizarre for the middle of November. But such it is. As you heard, it's currently 9 degrees across the Midlands there, and it's due to get a little bit warmer during the day too. So unusual highs in terms of temperatures, and lots of stuff happening out there, of course, as things begin to change a little bit. So what's been happening out across the Midlands? Well, the Queen of the Land Festival was taking place this weekend, and the winner will be joining us on the show a little bit later just to talk about her experience too and what winning the title might mean for her. Lots of stuff to cover throughout the morning. We'll have our full sports review later in the morning too. Plenty of stuff happening over the weekend in terms of local GAA, Premier League soccer, and all the rest in between. Rugby, of course, will feature heavily there too. We'll also touch on things like the bird flu, this outbreak that's happened up in Monaghan with turkeys, and a few other things to come there. So to begin, let's have a look and see what has been happening and what's in your papers this morning. Well, one thing that's really kind of caught the attention is that new laws to ban the sale of vaping products are set to be brought into place. Health Minister Stephen Donnelly is to see Cabinet approval to ban the sale of nicotine inhaling products to those aged under 18 from early in the new year. Now, vaping products are already banned in a number of European countries, and there's clear evidence that exposure to nicotine in adolescence can have long-term consequences for brain development. Mr. Donnelly will also restrict the types of retailers that can sell vaping products, reducing the number of outlets that can do so. He also intends to curb the advertising of nicotine inhaling products near schools, and that will also apply to some other settings frequented by children and young teenagers. He'll go further too. There might be a ban on advertising for vaping instruments and oils will also apply on public transport. And this is really coming on concerns both of people in the medical profession but also from parents, because they've become quite concerned at the proliferation of standalone vape shops across our towns and cities, not just here in the Midlands, but right across the country. Now, the most recently published surveys of Irish children, the Health Behaviour in School-Age Children Survey 2018 and the European Schools Project on Alcohol and Other Drugs 2019, showed that 9% of 12 to 17-year-olds had used e-cigarettes in the previous 30 days. I suppose the big question is, given the age of that survey, over 3 years old now, you would wonder, has that figure risen steadily? By all accounts, I think given the action the government are set to take on it, I think the answer to that question, unfortunately, is yes. What I'd noticed a lot over the past few months too is the amount of waste that these e-cigarettes are generating. Even on roadways, on streets, you just see these discarded vaping devices, and then the refill pouches as well. They seem to be just popping up everywhere in that. So look, action has been taken on that, but quite staggering to think that young children of that age are engaging in smoking e-cigarettes. What else is happening? Well, anyone that's looking at buying toys for their loved ones on the run-up to Christmas could face potential supply chain issues. Yes, those supply chain issues that first emerged during COVID and then with the blockage in the Suez Canal and everything else, they haven't gone away, And even a recent outbreak of COVID-19 in China is also likely to affect global supply lines when it comes to toys for Christmas. It's going to put a huge pressure on certain devices and certain implements, one of course being the PlayStation 5, and this is kind of stemming not just from supply chain issues in terms of delivery, but actually things like microchips and the very electronic components that are needed in order to produce these electronic devices and toys. Over 40% of Irish annual toy sales are traditionally recorded in the 8 weeks before Christmas. Demand is high for the PlayStation 5 and has reached a peak that many major retailers are sold out of the console and are awaiting restocking shipments, hopefully later this month and possibly into early next month. The demand, of course, everything is always supply and demand. People have been reporting also that online Some reselling sites are looking for at least €100 more above the regular retail price for PS5. So I think with things like Black Friday approaching as well, always be careful when you're going online. If you don't know it's a website you can trust, if it doesn't have the secure links, if it's not verified and you're a little bit uncertain of it, just be careful what you're clicking on and don't lead yourself down a little avenue that maybe you might regret as well. I heard a really interesting point actually made to somebody over the weekend that if you are using or buying online, you can get yourself like a single-use card, be it like a single-use Revolut or single-use credit card. So at least if you did try to purchase something from a fraudulent website, the amount of money they can access from you is pretty much zero, and the damage they can inflict on you therefore is almost negligible too. So lots of little things you can do. But if you are looking at reselling sites and looking to try to secure that gift for somebody, always do a quick background check and make sure it is a genuine and bona fide website. When we mentioned that C word, Christmas as well, another thing we all associate with Christmas as well as presents and toys is Turkey. And there's been restriction zones put in place in a farm around Monaghan because of avian influenza. The protection zone of 3 kilometres and a surveillance zone of 10 kilometres will be enforced by the department officials in an effort to prevent any further spread of bird flu. Poultry keepers with flocks located within the restriction zones are legally obliged to comply with the zone requirements to control movements of live poultry, other captive birds, hatching and table eggs, use litter, manure and slurry from poultry holdings. The department continues to advise strict adherence to these precautionary measures against avian influenza, or bird flu as it's known. Now, the department has urged poultry flock owners to remain vigilant for any signs of disease in their flock and report any disease suspicions to the nearest department regional veterinary office. We will bring you a little bit more on that throughout the morning too, and we'll get some more updates on exactly what the situation is in Monaghan and maybe get some advice and guidance for local farmers across the Midlands too. I'm a bit of a very sad story now. Friends and family in deep shock as schoolboy dies after falling from tree. The funeral of Daniel Butler will take place in Carlow on Wednesday of this week. The talented and athletic 13-year-old boy died after falling from a tree. It's believed he fell from the tree and landed on concrete. Daniel was known for being a talented athlete and was a member of Carlow Karate Club. He won karate tournaments, including the first place at the IKF International Karate Competition in Waterford 2020. Daniel was a student at Presentation College and a past pupil of St. Joseph's Boys National School. A tragic accident there in Carlow, and our thoughts and condolences from everybody here in Midlands 103 go to Daniel's family there on what is a horrendously sad occasion. My beautiful sister, you left a huge pain. That's the words of a man as tributes from a brother as tributes are paid over. As a man is quizzed over suspected murder of a woman in her flat. Miss Mihaela, she was 30 years old, was killed during an apparent assault at her home in Rathout over the weekend. Her body was discovered on Saturday evening inside her flat at the Riverwalk Court complex, where she had recently moved. Now, the man has been questioned by Gardaí in connection with the death of Miss Mihaela, and he was known to the victim, sources say. We don't know much more on that story yet, but I mean, unfortunately, it just sounds like, you know, isn't it a headline that seems to repeat itself? Unfortunately, and you know, I know big moves are being made by the Department of Justice too, and stuff like that, but we all can keep continuously asking that question, what more can we do? And moving on to tourism there, the Minister for Tourism, Catherine Martin, is spearheading a new campaign highlighting climate change and the impact tourism can have. That'd be a positive impact, I would assume, on climate change. A carbon calculator will be launched by Fáilte Ireland aimed at reducing greenhouse gases. And that's quite an interesting move, because I know within that hotel and hospitality sector over the past number of years, lots of them have engaged on lean management training programs for their senior staff, and then filtering that down then through all staff across the hotels or restaurants too. And there's a number of really interesting initiatives and training programs available through the various education providers around the Midlands that, you know, really aim at reducing waste, eliminating, you know, unnecessary usage of electricity and stuff. And that was happening way before the pressures were really coming on from rising energy costs and just the general cost of doing business in the first place. So good to hear what that initiative is, and I would like to learn more about that one too. More than 6,000 HSE workers are absent at any given time, as nearly 100,000 children are on some form of waiting list. An analysis of absence levels among the HSE workforce of more than 100,000 employees shows an overall rate of nearly 6%. The rate is highest among patient and client care workers at 7.94%, followed by general support staff such as porters. Around 6.6% of nurses and midwives are out, and the rate falls to 1.7% for doctors and dentists. This comes as the number of patients needing surgery rose to 79,882 last month, up from 79,280 in September. The high absence rate across the HSE was disclosed in a parliamentary response to Aintu leader Pádraig Tobin. HSE Human Resources official Marie O'Sullivan said that most absences were certified and not related to COVID-19. So, you know, as we know, COVID-19, you know, it still is out there. It still is causing a, you know, a risk as well, particularly to employees in the healthcare sector. But it's not the primary reason or the only reason there, according to the HSE. We are likely to be joined by Pádraig Tobin a little bit later to find out a little bit more about that, seeing as he raised that as a parliamentary question. Some positive news, maybe hopefully positive news, coming from the Ukraine, and it's the relief in Ukraine as Kherson after Russian occupation. Basically, the Russians just withdrew over the last couple of days, thanks to the effort and the sheer resilience of the Ukrainian army and the people there. Ukrainians in the liberated southern city of Kherson have expressed a sense of relief as they adjusted to life under Kiev authorities after months of Russian occupation. There were celebrations in the city's main squares. Some people were just dialing in and actually reconnecting with relatives all across the world just to let them know that they seem to have regained control of their home city. But some quotes that people said, they took everything with them. They cleared out the stores, one sales clerk was saying. They also said that the Russians switched off all the lights 3 or 4 days ago just as they were leaving the city, and they just vanished overnight. And really interestingly, they have taken most of the zoo's collection to Crimea, from llamas to wolves to donkeys and squirrels. Another Ukrainian soldier was heard to have said, apparently, and made the comments on Facebook. So the Russians, even as well as clearing out supplies and, you know, provisions, they also cleared out apparently the zoo in Kherson too and brought the animals to Crimea. Now, it's been put down as a major humiliation for the Kremlin because of the Russian army's withdrawal, but the Kremlin has remained eerily silent on that subject at the minute. And I suppose the big question is, what will the response be like when it comes? It's likely not just to be a verbal response, one would imagine. Hopefully not, though, and hopefully it will begin to restore some peace back into that region in Ukraine. Now, when we talk about late nights and partying and being up all night, a recent survey has shown that almost half of people think allowing nightclubs to stay open until 6 a.m. is a bad idea. If you remember, the Cabinet approved legislation last month that would allow nightclubs to stay open until 6 a.m. But more than half of people surveyed say that the move to allow pubs to stay open until 12:30 a.m. every night is a good idea, whilst half of them think allowing the clubs to stay open until 6 a.m. every night is a bad idea. Venues will be prohibited from serving alcohol after 5 a.m, but dancing can continue for another hour. Opening hours for late bars will remain at 2:30 a.m, while a new later bar permit will be required. If this legislation is passed by the Oireachtas, the changes are likely to be enacted next year. So it's quite interesting that half people think it's a bad idea. But I think with it as well, it all depends on where you are. If you're in one of the large urban areas and the big cities, you can see where it probably will be embraced and it will be something that will go ahead. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens around the Midlands, because certainly looking around, you would sense that in the last 10 years or 15 years, lots of nightclubs have disappeared and there's probably less of a selection around the Midlands towns. So it'd be quite interesting to see if they stay open, and maybe we'll have to put a team together here from the station and do a bit of research on that at some time and see who can last a pace. But a couple of other huge announcements. This is a big one. Britain's King Charles is celebrating his first birthday as monarch as he turns 74. He's expected to mark the event privately. There'll be a performance of Happy Birthday by the band of the Household Cavalry, and gun salutes will be fired across the UK capital in his honour. Wow, what a year is turning out to be for him. A very happy birthday, I suppose. From Prince Charles to Lindsay Lohan. Sorry, Prince Charles. King Charles, I should say. My apologies. From King Charles to Lindsay Lohan, you couldn't make it up, really, could you? Everything we know about Lindsay Lohan's new Irish rom-com for Netflix, from runaway bride shots to stunt double Criteria, the Parent Trap star of 36 was spotted here in recent weeks as a runaway McBride as part of Irish Wish. She's back in action on screens with a new movie deal with Netflix. She's currently promoting her new festive film, Falling for Christmas, which has landed on the streaming site this week. But the star has also been busy filming in Ireland for another new romantic comedy set for release in the new year. The scenes are being shot in County Mayo, and it looks like there'll be plenty of action in store as Lindsay was spotted running around Westport, dressed in a wedding dress and runners alongside, and a lookalike stunt double this weekend. Well, I can tell you, she wasn't the only person running around Westport in runners this weekend. Loads of people from around the Midlands were up there doing Sea to Summit, including my own wife, Mary. Well done, fantastic achievement. I think even Morris Fitzgerald, one of the sales reps from the station, did it as well. So well done, Morris. And I say loads of people from around the Midlands, something like 2,500 or more people compete in Sea to Summit every year. It's a nice simple one. You basically run out the road towards Kilpatrick. Get on your bike, cycle about 15 kilometres, run up and down Kilpatrick, cycle out over the Maugham, back into Westport, run the last 4 kilometres. It's a grand handy one. Yeah, absolutely bananas. I think the big one is 56 kilometres, which is some achievement. So well done to everybody who competed in Sea to Summit this weekend. And hopefully the legs and the backs and everything else are feeling okay. It is a huge endeavour, but a huge achievement nonetheless. Time for a quick break here on Midlands 103. Still to come before 10 o'clock. Toys are very much on our list, but not in that kind of way. We're going to talk about supply chain issues when it comes to getting toys ahead of Christmas. But speaking of Christmas, turkey is also an important thing. And an announcement came yesterday from the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. It has confirmed that test results have identified evidence of avian influenza H5N1 in samples from a turkey flock in County Monaghan. Further testing to determine the pathogenicity has been carried out, and we expect to have results over the coming days, as the statement from the department goes on. To find out a little bit more about this and see what the implications are, I'm delighted to be joined by Katrina Morrissey, and Katrina is news editor at the Irish Farmers Journal. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning, Ronan.
Katrina, can you tell us any more about this press release from the Department of Agriculture?
I can. I suppose it's really bad news in terms of poultry producers across Ireland would have been hoping to keep this highly pathogenic disease away from their flocks, particularly this time of the year. As you say, Christmas is so important to the trade for turkeys and lots of other poultry producers as well. It is, as you say, it's a highly pathogenic disease, which means that it spreads really fast and it affects a lot of birds very quickly. We have seen it until now only in wild birds, so this is the first domestic commercial flock. What does it do to the birds? If your bird has it, you'll see that it has a swollen head, discoloration of the neck and throat, generally will lose appetite, respiratory distress, diarrhea. Really, just it's a horrible disease for the birds to get. In order to contain it, unfortunately, the solution is that any flock that does test positive for it will have to be culled, and that will be probably already happening, that flock in Monaghan. And the hope now is that this will be able to contain it. So the department has put in 3 kilometre protective zones around this farm. That will be in place for 21 days. And then a surveillance zone, a bigger area, 10 kilometres for 30 days. And the idea is to lock that area down and hopefully try and keep it from spreading to other flocks in the area.
As you say, it has to be devastating news for the farmers or the business involved. Is there any indication as to the scale of the operation there and how many birds may be affected?
I believe it's around 3,000 in that flock. Unfortunately, and there's a lot of unfortunately in this story, because Monaghan is you know, one of the most poultry intensive areas of the country. It has over 100 intensive bird flocks, and between Cavan and Monaghan combined, they have 70% of Ireland's commercial birds. That's about 11 million birds, and they have 70% of them within a very tight area, because it's a very specialised farm now these days. You know, they're very intensive animals to maintain. You know, they require a lot of help. There's very specialised units. So there will be farms up there that have specialised in poultry for 20, 30, 40 years, and this is their sole livelihood. So it's really devastating for this particular flock, and we would hope that it won't spread any further.
Has the department issued any advice to, say, farmers who, even across the Midlands and further afield, like what can they do now, I suppose, to be vigilant of potential signs of bird flu?
Yeah, so there is a housing order in place, which means that all birds should be confined, and that doesn't just apply to a farmer. It applies to you or me if we have hens out the back. You know, they should be confined. And the idea behind that is that they don't come into contact with wild birds. Because wild birds, you know, a crow can go from my house to your house, peck at the feed in my backyard, and then go for the feed in your backyard. This is how this disease spreads. So the idea of housing all birds, and it's a mandatory order that all poultry should be housed at this stage, that they are kept in and they're kept away from wild birds, because this disease has spread within Ireland, but all the way across Europe, and it's generally linked this time of the year to migratory birds. And it is a huge problem. You know, 50 million birds have been culled in Europe so far. That's commercial birds.
And does it just affect commercial birds then, or can it actually, you say wild birds, I mean, basically everything is susceptible to...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it will affect all birds. I suppose the difference would be, and we have heard, you know, we've had reports of lots of birds along the coast. We've had lots of reports of seagulls and different types of birds along the coast succumbing to this disease. You'll have heard people finding gulls dead on the beach or dying on the beach. So it absolutely affects all type of birds. I suppose from a commercial point of view, these birds will be in much bigger flocks. So it has such a devastating impact then when they're in a bigger flock and have to be culled under the Department of Agriculture rules.
Yeah, it's going way bigger than just maybe lack of meat on a plate for Christmas when you think it can affect basically all birds out there as well. What's beyond the cull? What's likely to happen then on the farm in Monaghan? Like, is there a kind of a sanitisation process has to happen then,
yeah,
or do we know much about that?
Yeah, so there would be the cull, there would be an absolute complete clear out of all the units, there would be full disinfection process and a period of time before that place can be restocked, before each of their poultry houses would be restocked. As I say, those protective zones and the surveillance zones all have different rules, so there'll be limits on feed, feed trucks moving in and out of some of those areas. Huge, huge effort now being put into by farmers and the authorities, the Department of Agriculture, to try and clamp this down and hope that it is confined to that one farm.
And once it's confined to that farm, that shouldn't affect supply chains then, in terms of, you know, for the butchers around the country, if farms aren't infected, it's okay to continue as things stand.
Well, that's it. I mean, the hope would be 3,000 birds, while it is a large number of birds, it is turkeys and it is Christmas coming, there are a lot more farms that will be producing turkeys for the Christmas trade. I suppose, like everybody, will be urging to get their orders in early. But yeah, it should be okay, I think, if it is limited to one flock. Devastating, obviously, for the individual farmer involved. But if it doesn't spread any further, I don't think there'll be a problem. Within the next 2 weeks is kind of the crucial period for the Christmas trade, because obviously turkeys aren't processed on Christmas Eve. They get processed in the weeks coming up to Christmas. So a very important time for that trade and for those farmers involved and the butchers.
Yeah, hopefully that can be contained and doesn't spread any further than that. I mean, Katrina, thank you so much for giving us an update on that and actually pointing out the significance of it, and indeed how devastating it could be if it were to get out further. Katrina Morrissey is the news editor with the Irish Farmers Journal. Stay tuned, I'm going to play a bit of music now. After that, we're going to go and look at Christmas toys, because as well as maybe being challenges with turkeys, there might be challenges in getting certain toys ahead of Christmas too. I believe there is loads of good news coming on the show as well. Loads of good news coming up later on too. Yeah, I'm going to say it. Christmas is coming. We know that. Christmas is synonymous with turkeys. We've just spoken about turkeys. It's also synonymous with good times and toys. And as I just touched on the start of the show, good old supply chain issues that started a number of years ago and were really exacerbated with COVID and the Suez Canal. They're presenting again and they're potentially causing trouble for shops and for stores and for people trying to get their hand on certain toys and certain devices. Hopefully that's not the case, but let's try to find out a little bit more. I'm delighted to be joined by Breed Kelly from Kelly's Toymaster in Tullamore. Breed, I suppose it's not a probably new issue for ye, but to what extent are supply chain issues affecting the supply of toys this year?
Good morning, Ronan. I can honestly say it's not as bad as last year. Dribbling in, it may be a bit slower. Certain toys are, of course, nearly impossible to get. Anything electronic, toys with the chip in them, they're very, very, very scarce. But supply, Ronan, it's not too bad. I have a feeling next year will be worse.
Interesting, not Jenny. I suppose the thing around microchips and electronics, that, I mean, that is affecting every sector, like, you know, both in computers, electric cars, vehicles, all the like as well. So probably no major surprise there. But what are the main ones, I suppose, that are really in vogue this year? What are people looking for and trying to get their hands on?
Well, Pokemon, that is just phenomenal. I just don't know what happened with that. It's a kind of a card game or collect them, and no sooner did they reach the shop and they're gone and people are just looking for them again. And they are, you have to wait. They're what they call in the toy trade, you're on allocation, meaning I could get them in today, they're gone tomorrow, and then I can't say, well, I have them next week. You just wait until the new ones are issued and then you're on allocation, which means as soon as they're available for us in Ireland, they will send them in. But they are huge.
And
bicycles are another thing.
Oh, brilliant. Sorry, brilliant. I was going to say, like, it's quite interesting that it's a card game that, you know, because there might be a general assumption that everybody's looking for electronic devices for Christmas.
No, no.
So we've got cards and bikes. This is fascinating.
Oh,
keep going.
Huge. There's another, it's Irish handmade. It's farm toys, what they call. They are made up in Northern Ireland. They had some labour issues. And we got a delivery now the other day, but they're usually they're very good quality. But again, it's just labour issues was the problem with them. I suppose they're handmade, as you know, labour is a problem with everybody this year. And they're very good. What else is there? Pokemon. There's a new game out, Ticket to Ride.
Okay, sounds Beatles related.
Yeah, it's very good. The cover of it, of course, relates to the Beatles, young and old.
I have to say, it's so refreshing to hear that it's almost traditional ties to. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
I wonder, maybe is that just a COVID thing? Or just look at it's what's popular this year as well. But no, and really good to hear that you're not overly concerned by supply lines. I think there's always pressure on certain bits as well. Yeah.
See, we buy our first toy show for the following Christmas is in October. And then we go on, the final big one is in January. So I think this year we were ahead of schedule, for want of a better word. Now, we did take in the supplies much earlier than normal. So we're lucky enough. Now, there is always the odd toy who's a big seller and the company hasn't made enough of it or brought in enough of it. You'll always have that. But that's not major. It's nothing to do with COVID or... Then, of course, in China, they used to work 20, all around the clock, but now they're only, how many hours they're allowed to work. So that would be another issue.
Which mightn't be the worst thing as well overall in terms of...
I know. Oh, that was a great thing.
basic human rights,
exactly,
suppose, have to be considered as well.
Exactly.
But,
exactly.
No, Breed, listen, thank you for that update as well. It's great to hear that. Look, like yourself, you've got ahead of things as well. You've got good stock
We took supplies in early summer. This year, normally you would start in maybe August, September.
Brilliant.
But we've took May, June, so like not too bad.
Like everyone in retail, Christmas starts early in the year free. Thanks, Breed, and we'll talk to you again soon. All the best in the run-up to Christmas season. So maybe not to panic is the message from Breed Kelly there of Kelly's Toy Master in Tullamore. Yes, there's always kind of shortages of certain toys too. Lots to come here on Midlands Today between now and 11. Declan Power, security and defence analyst, will be along to give us the very latest from Ukraine. Also, you'll get to meet your new Queen of the Land, and we'll have a little bit of input from some school children around the things we need to watch out for in terms of road safety now that the winter months and the dark evenings are firmly in place. But to begin this hour, first I'm going to like to introduce to you Padraig Tobin. Padraig, of course, is the leader of AIN2 and a TD for Meath West. And it has recently been kind of disclosed through a parliamentary request that the HSE is suffering from what looks like to be quite a high level of absenteeism. So to find out more about that, I'm delighted to be joined now by Padraig. Good morning, Padraig. How did you come to look into this level of absenteeism in the HSE in the first place?
Good morning. Well, we in AIN2 have been trying to do an analysis of the health service to understand what are the major problems in the health service, why it's not providing for people, why, you know, next to 1 million people are currently on waiting lists for surgery and for help and for services from the HSE. And we're not getting that information from the government in general, so we've put in a large number of parliamentary questions to try and break down what are the issues and the difficulties. So we found out that on any given day, there are 6,000 HSE staff that are absent from work. which is a colossal figure when you think about it. It's the size of a town like Ballinasloe, for example. Just, you know, people who are not available for work. Now, that's out of a total population of about 100,000 people who work within the HSE. But it's an overall rate of about 6%. Now, that sends warning signs off straight away, because the average absenteeism rate within the workforce is about 3 to 3.5%. And so anybody that's operating a small business in any part of the country, you know, their staff will have to take certain days off, because, you know, every human being gets ill now and again. Every human being has, you know, issues that they deal with in their family, etc. But they usually don't add up to the level of days which is happening within the HSE.
Yeah, that, now, that 3.6%, I was just looking at some Small Firms Association research, that 3.6% equates to approximately 8 days. Now, they suggest that for larger companies, than bigger national companies, it's around 4.6% or 10 days per annum. So with the information you've got back about the HSE, does it break down whether there's long-term absences, or are these generally kind of short-term absences that are being referred to?
Well, the actual target for the HSE as well is 3.5% level of absenteeism. Now, between certain groups of workers, there's actually a far higher rate of absenteeism. So, for example, for those who are involved in patient and client care, it's nearly 8% absenteeism. For nurses and midwives, it's about 6.5%. But it's down as low as 1.7% for doctors and dentists within the sector. The major problem that I have within the HSE is that they don't break down the information properly. So while, you know, nobody wants to pry into the private issues of a particular worker as to why they can't make it into work, they don't actually get that information even for analytical reasons. So we don't know exactly why people are calling in sick or are not attending work. Now, they say that the parliamentary question that we've got back stated that COVID isn't the reason for this high numbers, but that they still don't know exactly what's going on here. So the first way to try and respond to this is for the HSE and the Minister for Health to try and break down exactly true questions to people who are taking time off. What is the reason for your time off? Because we know that when people take time off in the HSE for valid reasons, maybe because of stress, maybe because of overwork, maybe because of the pressure that they're under, and we know that people working in the HSE are under enormous pressure. And we want to be able to find ways to fix that first and foremost. But there's also a massive cost to this because, you know, I've estimated that there's 1.5 million working days lost in the HSE as a result of this. One of the reasons why the government spends tens of million euros on agency staff is because they're employing agency staff to fill the gaps. But even with employing agency staff to fill the gaps, there's lots of operations, lots of treatments, lots of engagements that have to be cancelled within the HSE. And that leads to, as people know themselves, nearly a million people waiting on waiting lists for surgery. 100,000 children currently in this state are on waiting lists for surgery. And many of them, 25,000 of those, are waiting for over a year for surgery. And as everybody knows, you know, when you're waiting for over a year for surgery, generally your health is getting worse. You're less able to participate in education or work. So this is a real issue in which the Minister for Health needs to focus on. We want to know what are the drivers that are pushing workers out of work on given days, and then to make sure we can put the necessary investments in to support those workers in their roles so they don't get into a situation where they're sick, overstressed, under pressure, etc.
How current are those figures? You know, like, are they reflective of up until recently, or are they slightly older? And indeed, does it show the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic may have had on absenteeism too?
Yeah, the figures that Aintu have received are up to date. So, in other words, the parliamentary question is very fresh, and it gives us a real insight as to what's going on at the moment. But it is interesting that the human resource manager of the HSE said that these figures were not related to COVID-19, which is obviously a good thing within the sector as well. So obviously there are people, like there isn't any job who are out because of COVID-19, but it doesn't account for the fact that the absenteeism rate in the HSE is double what it should be in the general population. And you know, if we're going to have a situation where 6,000 people are out every day, that's thousands of treatments, thousands of operations, you know, thousands of engagements that are simply not going to happen for people. And the health service is in real crisis at the moment. You know, one in four people in this state are on some kind of a waiting list in terms of a hospital appointment. And that means that there are people suffering needlessly as a result of the lack of health treatment. Now, if, you know, for me, the frustration is we have a minister who is not grappling with this, is not fixing this. With all the figures are getting worse in these terms. And one of the interesting things that we found out very recently is the numbers of adverse incidents are actually increasing significantly within the health service. So these are cases where people have been given the wrong, maybe medicine, the wrong treatments, or, you know, there's been slips or falls or something has happened to patients in the health service, which has actually made their health worse. And in some of these cases, they're so severe, they can end up in either a person becoming disabled or even death. And we know that in the last number of years, the figures of adverse incidents within the health service have significantly increased. So, you know, and the government is spending hundreds of millions of euros in paying out compensation in relation to this. So we really need to get to a situation where, first of all, we know why people are out. Second of all, that we put in the necessary investments to make sure that they can do their work without getting burnt out or overstressed, and that we can make sure that patients can access the timely treatment that they need so that they can actually get into better health faster. That's not happening under this government at the moment, unfortunately, and we in AIM2 are going to keep putting the pressure on them until they do.
The 100,000 staff approximately that work for the HSE, does that include agency staff? And indeed, is there any indication that the rates of absenteeism for agency staff are different than the general, than say, full-time employees?
My understanding is that it doesn't include the HSE or the agency staff. The agency staff, because they're not on a direct contract with the HSE, that they're not included. And it is a case where we're going to put in a parliamentary question now to find out, you know, what are the rates.
Would you have any ballpark? I mean, you've been close.
We don't. The information hasn't been given to us. So it would be wrong for me even to estimate in terms of absenteeism for agency staff. But it is a question we're going to pursue. Now, obviously, these are smaller figures in terms of the numbers of agency staff. But it would be interesting to compare and contrast to, you know, what's happening within the two sectors of workers within our service. You know, we know that the government, to pay for agency staff is far dearer than to pay for direct staff within the health service. So, you know, the reliance on agency staff is in itself, you know, an extra and needless cost to the HSE. And that's one of the things we need to do to get to end that practice, is to make sure that we have, you know, manageable absenteeism rates within the HSE. It simply, people are not going to get timely health service in this country until we make sure that all workers are able to do their job without getting burnt out, without getting overstressed, and we can bring down these figures.
Just looking here, the absence rates in the NHS kind of a June 2021 was around 4.6%. So your figure suggesting we're at about 6% here in Ireland. How realistic is it, do you think, that the HSE can get that to 3.5%, and how long might that take?
Well, one of the major problems we have with the HSE is that the HSE is an extremely opaque organisation. So in other words, it's very hard to see what's going on in any element of the HSE. There's a lack of transparency in the methods of management. So a normal private company or a business working, you know, in any town or village in this country has, on average, three levels of management. And if you look at the HSE, it nearly comes from that kind of British Army kind of, you know, management structure, where there's loads of different levels of management happening within the HSE. So there are managers who are managing other managers, if you understand. So what we need to do is get into a situation where the money invested in the health service gets to the front line, gets to the coalface, gets to the doctors and the nurses there. And one of the things that we in AIM2 want to do is we want to see a reform within the HSE so that hospitals are funded on the basis of the number of operations that they undertake, the number of treatments that they deliver, the number of consultations and engagements and diagnosis that they make. And we believe if the money goes to those elements of the activities of a hospital, those hospitals will have to orientate all of their staff and their structures more to the coalface, to the front line. And, you know, if you can see some hospitals now over winter will actually close down surgery for a number of months. You know, the idea that a hospital will get funded the same amount of money, even when it's not carrying out the surgery it's meant to carry out, is just illogical. So we want to see that money go to the front line and make sure that, you know, obviously patients get their treatments faster, but nurses and doctors have more support and better terms and conditions so that they can fulfill their job properly. And we believe that that will add to reducing the level of absenteeism that's happening within the health service at the moment.
And to hopefully deliver the services and the intervention that so many patients need as well. Padraig Tobin, exactly. Leader of AIN2 Mead West ED, thank you for joining us this morning. If you've got an opinion on that, and some of you have sent a few texts in already, but please do so, 083 3010 103, powered by the home of Offaly's top-selling car brand, Lamb Brothers Toyota, Arden Road, Tullamore. Get me here in the studio on text or WhatsApp if you have a particular view on that subject. Time for a quick break. After that, we'll be back with lots more stuff here on Midlands Today. Coming up before 11, you'll get to meet the new Queen of the Land, recently crowned just last night in Tullamore. But before that, we're going to touch on something that really hit the news over the weekend, and it could be a potentially very significant moment in the war in Ukraine, and it basically was the withdrawal of Russian artillery and soldiers from the Kherson region of the country. Now, last night, in his usual nightly video address, President Volodymyr Zelensky stated that investigators have already documented more than 400 Russian war crimes. Bodies of dead civilians and servicemen have been found. He goes on to kind of continue to reiterate his claims of war crimes and accusing Russia and Vladimir Putin of same. And, you know, basically they're uncovering what it looks to be more evidence even in the days since the Russian army pulled out. I'm delighted to be joined now by Declan Power from Mullingar. Declan is a security and defence analyst. Declan, what's the latest we know from Ukraine, and in particular from the Kherson region?
Well, and there's a lot of conflicting detail, other than it seems that the Ukrainians have successfully occupied the Kherson region. But the Kherson region is completely degraded now in terms of access to energy and the various things the civilian population would need to successfully function. That will probably be addressed successfully, especially with the external Western support over the coming weeks. But while it is it's a great moral victory in many respects for the Ukrainians and the Russians, it's adding to their tale of woes. It takes our focus off something that I think the Russians are trying to do. The Russians have been suffering hugely on the battlefield in Ukraine because of the various new weapon systems that the Ukrainians have been furnished with, particularly by the United States. And the IMAR system is one in particular that allow them to be able to coordinate missile strikes in behind Russian lines. So the reason that the Russians pulled out their men and material from the Kherson region is because they knew that there was a strong likelihood of them getting cut off, that the kinds of strikes the Ukrainians were launching were degrading weapon supply systems, ammunition supply routes and depots and things of that nature that would be needed to keep a unit supplied effectively while fighting. So if you have those kinds of strikes going on, while you have a big push going on coming forward to the troops defending the area, they could easily get cut off and then the Russians would be faced with an even worse disaster. So that's the good news side of it. However, what isn't being focused on much in the media reports at the moment is that success in the battlefield is something that has been leveraged or is attempting to be leveraged at the moment by the Ukrainians in getting better, longer range missile systems that would have the same accuracy, but they can launch further and deeper into Russian-held territory. And the fear in the West is that if those strikes go into actual Russian territory, not the annexed regions, but what is, you know, legitimately Russian territory, how that might escalate things. That's one concern. And then there's the other aspect, which is the Russians are not putting all their faith, they're not probably putting any faith at the moment in their combat troops in the battlefield, but they are putting their faith into Western support sapping for the Ukrainian war effort. And some of the listeners there will probably be aware of things like the noises coming from the Republican Party in the US about giving an unquantified blank check to the Ukrainians in terms of material support, weapon support, financial support. Similar noise is coming. The Italians, there were a number of protest marches, ostensibly for peace, but a peace that suits the Russians. At the moment, if you're to sit down to negotiate, the Russians haven't shown good faith in any negotiation so far. And this has been President Zelensky's point, that he won't sit down now and negotiate while Putin is in charge. That's a bold move. It pushes negotiations way off the map. Trying to restore them at the moment, then, if you're calling for that, then effectively you're calling for negotiations that are balanced in the favour of the Russians to some extent. And even in this country, we were hearing noises like the hotel industry want to go back to tourism. So the refugees somehow are, they're an inconvenience that have to be shoveled somewhere else. We can see our own political establishment has been woefully inept in their forward long-term planning, hoping that the war would have ended. So what the Russians are really banking on is that the West don't have the grit for the long-term support that's needed, and that that'll put political pressure on the Ukrainians, and that'll get the Russians off the hook.
Would that be the analysis then of the way they withdrew from the Kherson region, to an extent that it did seem like some civilians were saying it's like they just turned the lights off and left? Is it likelihood they are walking away in order to plan the next phase then?
I think what they're doing is hoping that they just want to consolidate in a way that they won't have pockets of troops cut off or be undermined any further, and that they'll limp along like this until the winter. And then the winter months will give them a few months in which to try other things to undermine the Ukrainian war effort, rather than purely kinetic and battlefield responses. In other words, hybrid warfare is about bringing the war in different ways, economically, politically. And I think that the Russians will be trying to do that, hopefully seeing maybe they'll be banking on an energy crisis in Western Europe and things of that nature that they would cause, as I said, support to SAP. Because the Italians, for example, having marches on the street that were allegedly calling for peace, but really saying we're sick of supporting this. The Republican Party making noises about not giving a blank check to the Ukrainians. That's grist to the mill. And all of those things the Russians will be putting an effort into trying to give momentum to that. They will be using all of their hybrid resources, their cyber resources, to try and push that, particularly over the winter months, on the basis that it could degrade the support coming into the Ukrainians. Now, I don't think that's likely to happen, in the sense that the European Union in particular has been so united and focused, because they realise, from not just a military point of view, but from a long-term political point of view, that it is essential that the European Union show leadership and support the Ukrainians. But it may come to a point, and this may be what some Russian strategic thinkers are hoping for, it may come to a point that some sort of a deal at a future point, and not for a while yet, but ideally maybe later next year, of where territory could be agreed upon that might be considered autonomous or semi-autonomous, so that the Russians can have some sort of an agreed outcome that they can sell to their own side as a victory of sorts. But at the moment, the Ukrainians aren't interested in that, because they have fought them to a standstill. They have bled hard to get the victories they've got, but they've also shown their ability that if they get the weapons, if they get the investment, that they're worthy of it. So they really want to push them out of their territory completely. And who can blame them in that regard?
Well, I think, who can blame them? And I think, even just the notion, and I'm sure this is some of the part of the thinking from Ukraine and Vladimir Zelensky, in ceding anything to the Russians and allowing them even some sort of, even if it's a fairly victory, you can understand why they might not want to do that. But it'll be interesting to see if the kind of almost retaking of the Kherson region, does that strengthen Ukraine's hand, or will they just pursue? I know there's some criticism of Zelensky over the weekend, again in some papers, asking at what point will he negotiate. But I think you can see from his perspective why he wouldn't want to do that.
Absolutely. Listen, personally speaking, I'd love to see them grind the Russians into the dirt for what they've done. And you can see there's more evidence of war crimes emerging. And on the weekend of Remembrance Sunday, we're reminded of the sacrifices previous generations have made in world wars. And particularly, I'm just conscious, I was at the service in All Saints yesterday, which was an excellent rendering of remembrance and Ruth Illingworth of this parish gave a very good account of the amount of Westmead men that had from all classes, backgrounds and creeds who fought in both world wars. So it reminds us that sometimes, you know, in order for the greater good to prevail, for stability, for democracy, you know, blood has to be shed. Nobody wants to see a war, but the Ukrainians were pushed, they were bullied into a war. Had they been taken into NATO on time, I doubt very much the Russians would have done what they have done. And so the Western world, the European Union, know in particular that if they were to roll over in this on so many levels, it would just embolden the Putin approach to geopolitics. And indeed, the Chinese are watching in the wings cleverly as to how this will pan out. So the line has to be held. But nobody wants to see it escalate either. Nobody wants to see it escalate beyond what it is. And I don't think even the Russian establishment want to see it escalate either. Okay, so
there's little to be gained from it.
Cool heads have to prevail at a certain point. Exactly. And so to go back to one point that we started, what does Kherson mean? It's not just a victory in the battlefield. It's a significant moral victory because it was the only city of any great note that the Russians had taken in their invasion. And now they have been pushed out of it.
So significant indeed, and let's see where it plays out over the coming weeks, and hopefully, you know, there will be some end to that in the near future. Declan Power, Security and Defence Analyst, thank you so much for that this morning.
Thank you, Ronan. Take care.
So to come, time for a quick break, but after that you'll get to meet the new Queen of the Land, who was crowned in Tullamore this weekend, and we'll also have a little input from some children about the importance of road safety and about being safe and being seen when out on the roads, particularly now that the clocks have changed and the evenings and mornings are getting that little bit darker. Coming up on Midlands today, between now and midday, the Sports Review with David Hollywood, our sports editor here. We'll go through all the major sporting events over the weekend, and there were quite a few and plenty of discussions there also. We'll also get a little bit of taster as to what's taking place in the Midlands Park Hotel in Portlaoise later this evening for the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards Gala Night being planned there. So it's all black ties and fancy dresses and everything else. So Brian Cunningham of Brian Cunningham Event Management will be along shortly to tell us about that and whet your appetites if you were one of the lucky people who's either shortlisted or indeed has secured a ticket for tonight's sold out event. But first we're going to go to a topic that has been a huge concern for business owners and indeed for pretty much every citizen over the last number of years, has been the cost of insurance. Well, later today the government will publish its third insurance reform implementation report. It's claiming now that 90% of the actions in its action plan for insurance reform have been completed or are currently ongoing. To find out more, I'm delighted to be joined by Fianna Fáil TD for Laoise Offaly and Minister of State at the Department of Finance, Sean Fleming. Good morning, Sean. The claims of 90% of the actions in the action plan for insurance are either complete or ongoing. Can you give an example of some of the things that have been completed already?
Okay, and thank you indeed for the invitation on this morning. The first thing is that when we came into government over 2 years ago, we wanted to deal with the cost of personal injury claims because I think everybody felt there was exaggerated claims and people need to, and it was out of sync with every other country in the world, the level of cost of claims, and people were claiming because there was a lot of money to be done there. So we got the judiciary, the judges, the 160 judges, to look at it because they know best because they're in the courts dealing with it every day, and they came out with new guidelines drawn up by the judges themselves at our request. And they've essentially, on most of the common smaller injury claims, they've reduced the amount that will be payable on foot of a claim by up to 40% in a number of cases. So that was a big thing. Now, that has all gone through. The insurance companies are holding it, the government parties are holding it, but some people, understandably, are not happy with the reduced amounts that they're getting now as a result, and they're challenging them in court. So some of these now are before the court. We've had test cases. Most of the test cases have won, but there's one in the High Court, and once the High Court stand over the new guidelines, I think we will see an immediate improvement. But the insurance companies have to wait off until such time as the judiciary confirm all these new figures.
What's the expected outcome then?
The expected outcome is that typically if somebody had an injury of about 20, which they were in historically going to get about 20,000 for, it might have been an injury to the back or the neck as a result of a car or a slip or a fall, and that will come in at about 12,000 now, which is still way higher than England and Northern Ireland and every other country, but it will be a big reduction from where we were.
And will that in turn, is it having a positive impact in terms of the actual price of premiums
already
that people
it
are paying?
In the motor insurance, the biggest issue is motor insurance in Ireland. Everyone of your listeners, I'm sure, will be affected by that. 2.2 million. They've already come down in the last year by over 10% because people feel these are going to happen. House insurance came down a little bit over the last year as well. 1.6 million people have house insurance, but inflation is starting to creep back up again. But the areas that we're most concerned now is about the businesses, the small businesses, and 92% of all businesses, you know, in the Midlands and everywhere, have a total insurance premium of less than 5,000 per annum, and that covers their employer's liability, public liability, and the cost of the buildings or offices they're working from. But we want that reduced, and that's why we have some other things coming in between now and Christmas to reform the duty of care. So if somebody has a slip, a trip in a shop, supermarket or restaurant or anywhere like that, up to now you could nearly be guaranteed of getting money, even if it was your own fault, if you weren't watching where you're going. So this is going to balance the risk between whoever property you're in and yourself. So if you're not watching what you're doing, you can't blame somebody else for it. And we have to pass new legislation to make sure that happens. And that's happened before Christmas.
A lot of those small businesses that were particularly affected by insurance premiums and maybe the fact that, you know, the last insurer had pulled out of the country were people in that, the entertainment and particularly children's entertainment sector as well. Is there this action plan that was going to tackle that sector and what can be delivered for them?
People probably didn't appreciate this, but when Brexit happened, you know, it doesn't affect, I think, too many people listening, but it actually happened businesses who had insurance, because a lot of the insurance we had in Ireland was done through London, and they're outside the EU and they've no authority to provide insurance in the EU now that they decided to leave. So we had a whole lot of areas that we've since resolved, like the play centres couldn't get insurance, bouncing castles couldn't, ice rinks in the few areas that people went to Christmas, the equestrian, the pony activities and the county pony competitions, and that was a very big issue in the local hunt. They couldn't get insurance 12 months ago, and we have them all sorted. But there's still a few sectors that we haven't fully sorted yet. And really, now that they've all got insurance, next year we want to get two companies offering them insurance, so we'll have a better price competition between the insurance companies. But those who had no insurance, a lot of them have now been sorted. But not them all yet.
Yeah, some of the criticisms that naturally come to any government initiative will be that it's still the insurance companies that are pocketing the profits from this. Like, okay, yes, the payouts are less. So if you look at the average price of a premium versus maybe the reduction in payouts, there's probably a big discrepancy there. Are the government doing any plans to be able to maybe put some of that money aside, indeed to tackle instances where maybe no insurance has been in place, or where somebody has been wronged and either party had no insurance, or how could that money be best utilised?
Well, a couple of things. The first point you make is, will the insurance companies pass on the savings, because their businesses and if their costs go down? I've met the chief executive of every one of the major companies in Ireland, insurance companies, three times in the last 18 months, and they've all said when these are guaranteed to come down, as in other words, when the courts stand over these new reduced awards, they will pass it on. And we've seen it already in the motor insurance, but we want to see it in relation to the business insurance, which we haven't seen yet. So that's really the task now for next year, that we have all the legislation in place to make sure the benefits are then passed on to the small businesses who are still waiting to see some reductions.
Absolutely, and very timely as well. And I suppose the sooner the better for them, given the challenges they're facing. But Sean, just before I let you go, I'm going to just move on. I know the news just reached us there before 11 of the sad passing of Vicky Phelan. You'd gotten to know Vicky over the last number of years.
I did. And first of all, I want to join with everybody. It's really a sad loss. And she was a true heroine of Ireland. You know, everybody looked up to her, admired her, saw how brave she was, fighting the battle on behalf of the women of Ireland who were let down by the cervical check, but even though she was struggling herself, and she was really an iconic figure and a mother and trying to do everything she could, and I just don't know how she did it. So Ireland has lost a true hero today, and I'm really sad for to hear the sad news this morning, because I did meet her in person a few occasions, and you know, I especially want to sympathise with her family, but everybody who felt very close to Vicky, because I think she struck a chord with everybody, and Ireland is the worst place today now that she has passed.
Sean Fleming, Minister of State of the Department of Finance, thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
And I suppose just to reiterate Sean's words there and just even pass on our condolences to Vicky Phelan's family on at such a sad time. Time for a short break. After that, we will go through the sports review and go through all the main items that happened over the weekend with regard to sport, both locally, nationally, and even a bit of international stuff, because it's such a bizarre time when it comes to soccer in particular, given that the Premier League season has ended and won't start back again until St. Stephen's Day. It's bizarre, but we'll find out exactly what's happening with David Hollywood very shortly. And also we'll get a little bit of a taster from Brian Cunningham about the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards that are kicking off from around 7 p.m. this evening in the Midlands Park Hotel.
The Monday Sports Review, brought to you by Slater Kia, introducing the new EV6 fully electric SUV with a range of over 500 kilometres. Find out more at Slater Kia Mullingar.
What a busy weekend of sport it was. David Hollywood joins me now for your sports review. David, very good morning to you. Where are we going to start? We're going to go to the Leinster Senior Hurling Championship quarterfinals. Lots of teams in action this weekend.
Yeah, good morning, Ronan. It was it would have made great listening for a period of time for Midlands listeners over the course of the Sunday. But as the results became more and more apparent as the weekend progressed, it was a significantly negative one. On the results front in the Leinster Senior Hurling Championship quarterfinals, the Laois, Westmeath and Offaly champions all departed the Leinster Championship, unfortunately. We'll start off with Clonbillocullagh's game in Dublin against Kilmacud Crokes. Clonbillocullagh did beat Crokes on the way to the Leinster final last year. Laois, three times champions, last season's Leinster finalists. They were thought probably of the three Midlands clubs to have the best chance in Leinster this weekend. They still would have been underdogs, admittedly. Their prospects were severely damaged when Brian Corby got a straight red card in the 25th minute. They conceded two early goals in that game. Brendan Scanlon and Oisín O'Rourke left it at 2-7-7 in terms of a half-time lead. And the game's not done at that stage, but they concede four consecutive points in that second half. They did rally midway through. They scored through Stephen Bergen, hit the back of the net, and then got a point straight after that. They got within 4 points at that stage, and again then Kilmacud Crokes rattled off four consecutive points without reply, and that effectively ended the contest. Disappointing for Clonbillocullagh, who definitely were feeling full of the joys of life after decent performances in the run up to this game. Declan Laffin, as you can hear here, was understandably in reflective mood after the game.
Look, things didn't go our way. There's no point dressing it up, I suppose. Look, we knew we were coming into a tough spot to you know, any time you're away in club championship is really, really difficult. Look, we had them in Port Laois last year, and it was on the other foot today. And look, you know, descending off and things went again, yeah. And that's what happens when, you know, you make bad decisions when you're under pressure at times, and that's what we've done today, unfortunately.
You were in a great position there after a quarter of an hour, 5 points to two up, your dander was up, you were going fairly well, and then the two goals in 2 minutes was a real sickler.
It was, yeah, without a doubt, because if we're being honest, to be fair, even though they had a spare man for most of the rest of the match, from what, 5 or 6 minutes later, they never really looked like scoring another goal. Okay, maybe you can say they didn't need to go for it, but look, yeah, we were in a great spot. 5-2, we probably had a chance to go maybe 6. And they got one very soft goal, I suppose, and then they got they went for the juggler and got in for a second, and we kind of tried to recover and get our bearings, and then we suffered a sending off, and look, things, it was always an uphill battle. But look, to be fair to the boys, they came out to battle hard. I think we got it back to 4 after we scored the goal.
Yeah.
I had another chance maybe to get it to 3. I'm not saying we would have got there, but what was left? 15 minutes? 12? 14 minutes, I think, was left at the time. You know, it could have been a different game, and then a few bad decisions again. But look, that happens when pressure's on, and you have to learn from it. And you know, as someone says to me, you know, the sign of great hurlers makes the right choice when in the most, you know, pressurised situation, and that's the bottom line.
Of course, the team that Clonbillocullagh faced in last year's Leinster final, Ballyhale Shamrocks, were in action yesterday, widely regarded as one of the strongest teams in the championship at the minute. They were out against Castletown Gagan. How did this one fare out, David?
You don't want to go to Nolan Park after you win the county championship. Generally, Castletown Gagan had that poison chalice, I suppose, is what you'd call it. And Ballyhale Shamrocks, they put on an exhibition of finishing in Kilkenny on Sunday. The game totally ran away from Castletown in the first half. They registered 8 wides to Ballyhale's 4 in that opening 30-minute period. Now, bear in mind, they were 10 points down at half-time. Now, naturally, you you don't like just imagine, oh, 8 points instead of eight wides would have meant they're still in it, because naturally, if you're messing with things to that degree, you have to consider Ballyhale's four wides as well. But the reality is, Castletown Gaeg and Alan Mangan's side needed to hit their straps and kind of 10 out of 10 every metric in the game to compete with Ballyhale Shamrocks, and taking your chances when you're the underdog is absolutely one of those requirements, and they didn't do it, and ultimately they didn't really get close to doing it. The final scoreline doesn't make for pretty reading. 5 goals and 25 points to 15 points. Kilkenny's champions, last year's Leinster champions. They'll be favourites for provincial honours again this year, and possibly in All-Ireland as they seek to right the wrongs of last year's final defeat. Alan Mangan, he watched his side strive but failed to challenge in this game, and the team's manager was pretty admiring of what is a remarkable Kilkenny side.
To be fair to them, they're the best club team of all time. Like, I know we were, for any of us who were lucky enough to see Burr playing back many years ago, but these lads are exceptional. Sure, they've lads coming out of everywhere and scoring points from everywhere and scoring goals. Like, the three or four goals they scored in the second half have been outrageous, and they're a phenomenal outfit. And we came down here to pit ourselves against them, and hopefully Burr could account for ourselves. To be honest, I don't think the scoreline suggests we played reasonably well. We'd 9 wides in the first half and 5 into the goalie's hands. If we converted half of those, that scoreline wouldn't look half as bad. But listen, I'm extremely proud of these lads. They put in a massive effort all year, and they're a great bunch of lads.
Goals always win games. They got 5-2 in the first, 2 in the second, and you know, your keeper had a great game as well. There could have been more, but I suppose they took their chances very quick.
Ah, the DJ, no, in fairness, our goalie made two great saves in the first half, and they ended up getting a goal off one of them. And I thought the first goal was very lucky, and that was a sucker punch at the start of any game when we're trying to keep ourselves in it. But sure, listen, at the end of the day, these are up there with the very best in the country at the minute, and I'm pretty sure that they're going to probably will win the Leinster, and they're going to be a serious outfit when it comes to All-Ireland contenders.
Sinn Raun, of course, first-time champions of Offaly, just this year. Dream for them after many years of youth development and progress. They secured they got the Sean Robbins Cup this year, but their dream, has it continued in Leinster, David?
Final scoreline of Naas 4-21, Sinn Raun 18 points, which is a conclusive no, unfortunately. That being said, you know, I said Castletown Gaeg didn't want to have to go to Nolan Park on Sunday as reward for winning the county championship. Sinn Raun win their first Offaly championship, and they get drawn with the champions of Kildare in Leinster. You can certainly do worse, but ultimately I think a lot of people are sleeping on the quality of this Naas side. A dream run to a county title for Sinn Raun. The Leinster Championship campaign ended at the quarterfinal stages over the course of the weekend on Saturday. They played and they competed gamely with Naas throughout. Just 5 points between the two sides at halftime, 2-7 to 8 points. Goals for Naas being crucial. Goals in all of these games actually really having a crucial effect. Now, we can take the Ballyhale Shamrocks win as relatively inevitable, but Kilmacud Croke's got 2 goals in the first half an hour against Clough Ballacolla, and similarly here, 2 goals in the first half for Naas did for Sinn Raun. They scored another 2 in the second half, it has to be said. It was a physical affair. Last year's intermediate champions, they were deserving winners in the end. Trevor Fletcher and his side will always have O'Connor Park on the 2nd of October when they added Kilcormac Cloughy to the pile of favoured teams that they beat to that county title. But their run ultimately finished up over the course of the weekend on Saturday. Trevor Fletcher was certainly praiseful of Naas, and I think reflecting relatively positively on his side's championship experience.
When they got their third goal, I think it was our lads dropped their heads. We put a lot of getting back close, and I just said it to the boys on the sideline, we couldn't get a blow to 3 points, and I felt if we had to get a blow to 3 points, it would have tested them. But in fairness to them, in fairness to Naas, they were probably the more hungry team on the day. They hunted in packs. Every time any of our lads got in the balls, there's 2 or 3 lads around us. And unfortunately, it's one of those days for us. And 100%, I don't think the scoreline reflects the effort that our boys put in. And for one thing for sure, anyway, I'm very proud of their performance here and the year they had this year.
Obviously, you know, you knew the hand you were dealt. Big gap from the county final until today probably didn't help. The loss of the likes of Killian Ryan and especially Kieran Cleary maybe made you change tactics a small bit. And the tight confines here now, but maybe you didn't get to play that expansive game inside in your full forward line.
Yeah, look, I speak about controlling the controllables. We couldn't do that in about the 6 weeks. I felt our preparation was quite good coming into it. We had 4 very good matches. After last Thursday's match, I was quite confident if we put in performances, we would have had a good shot at it. And I don't think today's performance was good enough. And that's just the bottom line. And I suppose with Kieran gone and Killian coming off the bench, we had to adjust and we had to start using the ball a little bit more. And to be fair to Nace, I thought the work rate was outstanding today. Like, they scored a point when there were, I don't know what it was, 13, 14 points up, and they turned the ball over. You know, that to me is a sign of a good team.
Yeah, maybe outthought and outworked on the day. Nace progressed to play Ballyhale Shamrocks in Croke Park on Sunday week in the Leinster Senior Hurling semi-final. The other semi-final sees St Mullins. They take on Kilmacud Croke. St Mullins, champions of Carlow, beat Ferns St Aidan's in the fourth quarter final. So that's it. No Midlands club representation when it comes to the Leinster Senior semi-finals. But certainly they provided plenty of kicks and entertainment throughout their respective championship campaigns over the course of this season, Ronan.
There was some Midlands representation in a Leinster Senior Camogie semi-final this weekend too.
There was indeed. Ular Tabala were comprehensive winners in St Brendan's Park against Birr, unfortunately 5-16 to 1-7. Goals in St Brendan's Park buried Birr in this one. Conditions were difficult. Joe Troy was there, and as he describes it, certainly the ball was holding up terribly on what was a sodden pitch. Ellen Regan did score a very nice one for Birr, but it was all over by then thanks to Shauna Sinnott. Ultimately, they were very much impressive in taking the county title in Birr over, but they were well dispatched by Wexford champions Ular Tabala.
Thanks, David. Time for a short break, but David will be back after the break to continue the sports review, where we'll be discussing rugby and how an average Ireland managed to beat Fiji at the weekend, and also we'll have a look at all the major soccer results across the weekend too, and maybe have a little taster as to what might be coming in Qatar, because hard to believe we're in November and it's World Cup time. But anyway, all that and more after this quick break.
The Monday Sports Review, brought to you by Slater Kia. Introducing the new EV6 fully electric SUV with a range of over 500 kilometres. Find out more at Slater Kia Mullingar.
David Hollywood joins me in studio here for our sports review. David, we're going to move on to rugby next. Ireland were out against Fiji at the weekend, whilst we were always expected to beat them. A little bit of kind of negativity around the manner of the victory, though.
Yeah, it was a disappointing performance ultimately after what was a great result against South Africa. I would say in that result against South Africa, though, the performance wasn't exactly hallmark accurate or anything to the best of what we've seen from this Ireland side, for instance, when they were on that winning tour against the All Blacks. This time out, the excuses can be laid at the fact that they changed large portions of the team. Jonathan Sexton comes out and Joey Carberry comes in at 10. Robbie Henshaw was supposed to start against South Africa, and a hamstring injury precluded him from starting or playing any part in that game. He did start against Fiji, and bad news on that front, unfortunately, which we'll touch on. 35-17 was the final score. It's an 11th straight win for Ireland, and they're cruising up on a record set by Joe Schmidt when Ireland were last world number one. Bear in mind, any criticism here is within the context of them being the best side in the world by the world rankings. And you know, we're critical of performances in beating the world champions last weekend, beating Fiji this weekend. Australia will be in Dublin this coming weekend, which will be a really interesting game because they lost to Italy, remarkably. They basically did what Andy Farrell's side did in choosing a changed side, Australia, after they nearly beat France. They put out a second 15 essentially against Italy, but it's a sign of Italy's potential progress maybe ahead of the Six Nations and Australia's relative lack of depth ahead of the World Cup that they lost that game. So it would be really interesting to see Ireland take on Australia when it comes to this weekend. A clean sweep in the Autumn Nations series is in offer for them. Errors and inaccuracy were big problems for Ireland. Nick Timoney's brace of tries, the Ulster back rower, were probably a highlight of the first half. The low light, as I said, was Robbie Henshaw's injury problems striking once again. He started this game at 13. However, Gary Ringrose had to come on for him, and Andy Farrell had this update on the Athlone man's fitness after the game.
Felt his hamstring. He doesn't feel like anything was too serious. He felt like he cautionally came off in time to make sure that he's not done any more damage, so we'll just see how it is tomorrow.
Yeah, so hopefully, by the sounds of it, it's not too serious. Maybe it's a case of take him off for the majority of the game against Fiji, buys you 80 minutes of Robbie Henshaw come this weekend. It's a real pity because his Leinster form this season has been standout, and generally his consistency over the last couple of seasons, I would say he's one of the best centres in the game at the moment. As we said, the notable results elsewhere, Italy with that 1-point victory over Australia. England were easy winners over Japan after they surprisingly lost to Argentina the weekend previously. That Argentina team lost to Wales, and South Africa were beaten by 4 points by France in what has been an entertaining autumn series in the rugby thus far. Domestically, Buccaneers, they're clear of the top of the table in Division 1B of the AIL. Remember, they were promoted last season. Eddie O'Sullivan is now at the helm, the former Irish head coach, and UCC were top of the table until the weekend before this latest round of fixtures. Then it was UCC and Bucs at level on points, and they faced off over the course of Saturday. 29-0 it finished in Dewberry Park. So Buccaneers really impressive in that. I saw a couple of the tries, and just good hands, good lines, good organisation. They seem to be relishing the tight stuff in terms of the forward play. And as I said, the backs are penetrating. To score 29 points without reply is very impressive. And Tullamore, they are second to Instonians in Division 2C. Another victory for them. Finished 29-10, that one taking place in Offaly. And they look like good candidates to at least make promotion playoffs. That being said, we're only a short way into the season so far, Ronan.
And it is rugby. And if you just, even the results you gave there from the test series, like, you know, they're all over the place in comparison to more traditional things, which kind of really whets your appetite for the World Cup next year. At least it's not looking like it's a given for anyone, and that's good. We'll come to the Soccer World Cup very shortly, but we'll move on. First, the FAI Cup final took place yesterday. Derry City were the overwhelming favourites going in. Did that come to pass?
It did, ultimately. What played out, from how I saw the game, was very much a side of greater technical ability using that. And in a cup final, that's never guaranteed necessarily, but they managed to get their foot on the ball. Exposed space in behind Shelburne's fullbacks, particularly goals from Jamie McGonigal, a brace from Cameron McJanet, and a goal late on by Jordan McAniff sealed Derry's first cup win since 2012. They were much the better side. It's funny, like, a lot of the focus was on Damien Duff because he's the manager of Shelburne, and I kind of think that's unfortunate. I saw one of the lead sports stories elsewhere today was Damien Duff's reaction to his side losing the FAI Cup final. Yeah. And he's talking about how he walked in there 10 feet tall with pride and he'll do likewise leaving, and that's all very well and good. But he's, you know, we're personalising the FAI Cup final here around Duffer, which is somewhat unsurprising, but also a little bit daft. I think Derry City deserve far more plaudits for the way they've played this season. They narrowly missed out in the league to a very, very good Shamrock Rovers side, and they are cup champions, and they are a coming side as well. They're well resourced, they've got a good squad, and it wouldn't surprise me if they're even closer to Shamrock Rovers next season, or indeed leading the league.
Yeah, I heard it kind of said the other day, like, actually, that maybe, you know, Shells were possibly, you know, punching a little bit above their weight, that they reckon the Duff factor might have been something to do with that. That for a guy who was famous, you know, when in his playing days, as I've known, has been almost kind of a bit lazy off the pitch, it turns out he's actually a kind of high performance.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's up, he's watching games every day of the week, he's at stadiums, you know, so they reckon that gave Shells a bit of a boost anyway. But
He's really well regarded. And
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, he coached at Celtic for a long time, kind of earned his stripes there, and they're so praiseful of him, and Shells have improved tangibly under him, but they're only recently back into the Premier Division. They've secured their status in the league comfortably this year, and if they continue to progress, then that FAI Cup final appearance won't be an aberration. They can get back there again, but hopefully the frenzy around Duffer being part of the league and that stuff can calm down a bit so the clubs get their platforms correct.
Do you know who one of his biggest fans during his playing days at Chelsea was?
Go on.
Claudio Ranieri's mother. She apparently used to love the Duffer, and she used to insist to Claudio that he was put in the first team every week. Fairness to Damien, he was flying at the time. He was one of the best players in the Premier League.
So he was.
Hats off. An Irish legend, if ever there was one. David, give us a quick look, overview of the Premier League results, which culminated in the game between Man United and Fulham yesterday evening, which is the last game until St Stephen's Day because of a World Cup.
Yeah. it's really odd. You're watching something that has this desperate end of campaign feel to it almost, you know. It became an end-to-end game. I think there was a concern this weekend in the Premier League that with the last round of fixtures before the World Cup, people would be putting in, pulling out of 50-50 tackles and all that type of thing. It seemed to be more full-blooded than usual in the games that I saw. And Fulham, they could have been two or three down in that game against Manchester United before midway through the second half. They then equalised, and at that point they started to dominate proceedings in the game, and United getting ever more desperate towards the end of the game through on Garnacho, who looks like a real player, and Garnacho managed to pull off a 1-2 and put a great finish into the bottom corner to give United a crucial 3 points. They're 3 points off the top four heading into that break with a game in hand on fourth, that is Spurs. Saturday's results were interesting as well, seeing Manchester City lose to Brentford 2-1, which was a surprise to say the least. Liverpool back to winning ways. How long will that last? We don't know. They were 3-1 winners. Spurs doing Spurs things by winning a game 4-3. They were really abject in the first half, as they nearly always are. They were trailing 2-1, and a late Betancourt double managed to keep them right on target for the top four. And I suppose the coming side, Newcastle, they were 1-0 winners over Chelsea, and Arsenal won again as well. So Arsenal are 5 points clear at the top of the league.
And that was the big question a month ago, was, I know they probably won't be there by the time the World Cup starts. They're there, and City stumbling, which I have to say I take a little bit of pleasure in. It's great to see. But you know, Arsenal are there, they've proven it, so it'll be very interesting to see what happens after World Cup, which kicks off when?
It's kicking off very shortly indeed. I think they've got basically a week's break to calibrate themselves into the international setup, and then we'll be watching the opener in Qatar. And
Is it Qatar versus Senegal?
It's not the best opener.
Because originally it wasn't the opener, but then they kind of brought it forward because usually the hosts do open the tournament or something like that. But it's probably not one that's going to be on people's. Where do you think people sit with it? Because a number of players have spoken out over the last number of months, and even recently, and I know the Danish team were planning on wearing a kind of a slightly downgraded jersey just to try to maybe put some spotlight on human rights issues in Qatar and that region. But players have been out, some have been vocal, some are kind of maybe, well, where do you think the average punter sits? Like, is it just that we're so unused to a World Cup in winter that we haven't got our heads around it, and when it starts people will just engage en masse? Or will people kind of, you know, is it slightly tainted, I suppose, is the question.
I think there's more of a chance that it'll be tainted with hindsight, as these things tend to be. And in the build up is certainly not ideal. You like that kind of break between the club season and then the anticipation building up. People start reading like the preview articles and getting genuinely excited. I don't think anyone's engaging with the World Cup in a traditional way at the moment. It kicks off this Sunday, by the way, so that's no time at all. Qatar against Ecuador, which will get
Ecuador,
the pulses racing.
Yeah.
The following day then, England take on Iran and Senegal. They are in action early on. They take on Netherlands, which is probably the first really interesting game that comes up in that World Cup. But to answer your question, Ronan, I'd say yes, when it starts, everybody's going to, like I will, you get back and you just stick the game on because it's a World Cup and it's got that kind of sense of gravity to it.
It's the chance to see all the best players in the world in kind of, you know, over a couple of weeks. So it's hard to get away from the allure of that. But like Bruno Fernandes has been raising kind of, you know, his concerns about it too. But I suppose overall, it's generally quiet. Like, no teams have pulled out or no players have made a statement say they're not going. So it's pretty much going ahead as planned.
The magnetism of the World Cup, people aren't going to boycott it in that respect. I know it's slightly apples and oranges, but if you look at the fact that there was an Olympics, a Winter Olympics and a World Cup in Russia, and then very shortly after that we had what happened in Ukraine, and they had already annexed Crimea and transgressed in Georgia in the preview to that. And now I'm going way left field. And Qatar aren't Russia in that respect, but it just gives you pause for thought in terms of bringing World Cups to places without due regard for what is going on in those places. So it's going to be very interesting to observe the relative form of all the sides and what happens to the clubs afterwards, and how this World Cup will be remembered. I don't know, Ronan.
Interesting. It could be an opportunity to maybe really put a global spotlight on some of those key issues, bringing from a human rights perspective, not just maybe in Qatar, but further afield. David, time is up there. You had Ronaldo on the list, but I think we should leave Ronaldo alone, poor devil. David Hollywood, thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
God, I almost lost my breath there because the atmosphere in the station, it's filled with hairspray and fake tan and nail polish, and I mean there's fantastic fabrics on the go around here and lots of mascara, all ahead of the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards, and that's just Roy Jennings, by the way. But as I say, the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards are taking place this evening in the Midlands Park Hotel. It's a gala event, it's sold out, people are getting highly excited about it. To find out a little bit more though, I'm joined by event management, Brian Cunningham from Brian Cunningham Event Management, who partners in the events along with Midlands 103. Brian, have you got the glad rags on?
I have the glad rags on, and just before I start, I want to echo, as you probably have heard, Ronan, this morning, the death of Vicky Phelan.
Yes.
And I think it's important for us to recognise and pay our respects to the family and friends of Vicky Phelan. She's an incredible woman. We had a very good friendship, and our thoughts are with her family and many friends this morning who are at her loss. And there's a lot of gratitude owed to Vicky Phelan, and hopefully, as her message was, that people and our government will learn from the mistakes that have been made by so many women haven't received wrong results, etc., etc. But answering your question this morning, are we ready for the awards? We're here in Colm and Anthony Neville's property at the Midland Park Hotel. It is awash with getting ready. The Colm and Anthony and Dara Cruz and George and all their team here at the Midland Park always put on a great show. I know there's great excitement. I'm getting phone calls for tickets. Unfortunately, there is no tickets. I know that the team at Midlands 103... Will and Rebecca and Katrina and all the team there have worked very hard on putting the awards together. It's a sold-out show tonight, as it always is, and it's going to be a good crack. There's going to be a lot of lovely stories here tonight, Will, or Ronan as well. I was going to say Ronan Berry is going to be MC with Shawnee Morris.
Whoever he
is. And there is going to be a wonderful night of reflection. Obviously, we have that special award for my good buddy. It's a bit of a bittersweet day for us today at Midlands because, obviously, it's the first award that Albert Fitzgerald will not be here side by side. And we'll remember Albert tonight as well. For the work that he did and his contribution.
Absolutely,
and someone will receive that award as well.
Because it's a sector that deserves a chance to celebrate.
100%. It's been a really tough, challenging number of years. There is other challenges coming down the line and being thrown at the hospitality industry. More and more challenges, electrical costs, everything has been thrown. And it's time now that tonight we'll forget about it, but we'll come together as an organisation, as a unit, and as a family, and celebrate and have a really great night, and we're really looking forward to it. And I know drinks are starting at 7 o'clock. There'll be a call for dinner from about 7:30. Dinner's at 8, and then the awards should start about 10:15, all going well tonight. And of course, lots of surprises on the night as well. And who will win the big awards? We'll be telling you all of that a little later on this evening. And as well as that, I know it'll be covered on your news stories tomorrow as well.
Absolutely. No, it's a great event. It has been a huge success over the years. And I think, as you say, it's sold out. People are already getting excited about it too. And is it over 55 awards about to be given out this evening?
There is indeed. And I'll tell you what, Ronan, the pressure is on this evening. So there's pressure on you this evening. We like to do the awards because some people think, oh God, you know, it'll be there all night. No, we have a formula in place, as you know, Ronan.
Absolutely.
You've been involved with it from the start. And basically, that formula works very quickly. And, of course, we have a great night of dancing. The wonderful Lowell's wedding band will be there. They will be there tonight performing, and Kathy and the boys who always do a great job. There'll be some great drinks reception. Of course, Dermot Guinan is there during the meal, and there's going to be a wonderful atmosphere. It's a night to relax, it's a night to celebrate, and it's a night to give back and reward. And thank you so much to the listeners of Midlands 103 for voting in their thousands this year, of course, for voting in their thousands and selecting who they believe. And this is something really important, as I always say when it's rolling, is that it's important that you can win awards all over the place. When you win an award at home, it's very special. And as the largest media outlet in the Midland region, it's only fitting that Midlands 103 should be doing these awards.
To say the same about winning the club championship or that, it's special when it's with your hometown. Brian, thanks a million. We'll let you back to getting ready, and no doubt we'll see you later on this evening.
Brian Cunningham there from Brian Cunningham Event Management ahead of the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards taking place, as Brian said, in the Midlands Park Hotel from 7pm this evening. It's going to be a bumper occasion, a celebration, a feast with music, dancing, awards, great stories, all the rest. For more great stories, join me on Midlands Today tomorrow from 9pm. Carl James is coming next on Midlands 103 with the afternoon show. I'll talk to you all in the morning.